Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, you watched the Brits. That's very brave of you.
I watched the Brits, which I haven't done for a while, actually. And it was, but I saw most of it, actually. And, I know.
I know.
I did feel a bit of an old curmudgeon because I missed the old days. What an unoriginal thing to say. But I remember...
To interrupt for a second, we've always missed the old days with the Brits. Yeah. And even in like 1986, the Brits, it's not as good as he was.
Not as good as it was.
Anyway, go on.
I know. Yeah, you had Mick Fleetwood and Sam Fox, and everyone's going, this is a catastrophe. Years later, again, wasn't it great when Mick Fleetwood was live? It was risky, it was daring, it was funny. I just felt nostalgic for that, the mid-90s, really, where you had lots of groups. You had Blur, winning 2 or 3 awards. You had M People, you had Oasis, you had REM. You'd have Supergrass, Bon Jovi, Massive Attack. Even the dance categories were a band. Everybody was a kind of a band. And this time I kind of felt it was just the solo artists, aren't they?
Is that what it is?
Yeah, so you've got Adele and you've got Ed Sheeran, you've got Silk Sonic and Billie Eilish and Little Sims. And Olivia Rodrigo and Dua Lipa, and they're all there, and they're all really presentable, and they're fabulously turned out, and they're terribly welcoming and accommodating towards each other. It's a bit like watching a kind of film awards where everyone's terribly nice about each other because they might work together.
Yeah.
Whereas in music, it used to be in the days of the bands when bands roamed the earth, they were kind of self-contained units, rather like football teams, actually. That were kind of playing a match and you're rooted for one and you wanted them to win and they were rivals and they said unkind things about each other. And, I can remember being at Brits once and seeing Blur, I think it was, or about to go up and get the award. And they knew they were going up to get this award. And just before, when they handed around a packet of cigarettes and all lit up a cigarette. Okay. And one of them carried a bottle of lager.
Yeah, it's all
And they stormed up on stage. One of them probably dropped the microphone and one of them said something that apparently spontaneous. They thought about very cleverly to get them into the papers that kind of dissed Oasis, And I kind of loved all that, really. And it just seemed terribly polite now. And that's all I had to say is I miss the great days when there were bands.
A band is a drama in itself.
A band is a football team that you support, you want to win or lose. And they're rivals. And there's that kind of friction.
But also within the band, there's always one member of the band who might go off on one. One member of the band who behaves. It just doesn't matter who the group is. It will always come down to that. Whereas you have an individual, you can't have that. Now, it's funny you should say that about bands, because I just read a piece that really irritates me in the Sunday Times today. One of those... There's many, you get these regular kind of comment pieces about how streaming is ripping off bands and so forth, written by middle-aged arts critics. So you think they're all kind of harking back to, so there was apparently, I must have missed it, Mark. I don't know if you saw it, But there must have been some golden age, maybe in the 70s or the 80s, when all bands were perfectly happy with everything they were paid. And they were always saying, you know, it's a very good, it's a living wage. I'm really happy with this. It can go on for a while. You know, I've had my annual review. It's going to go up by 5% next year and so forth. I don't remember that happening. But apparently, according to these people, it did happen. The headline, anyway, of this piece is, for bands of tomorrow, mega deals have a sting in the tail. Get the topical hook.
Yeah,
or sting sold is...
I see what they've done.
Whatever it is publishing or is it recording catalogue sometime in the last couple of weeks. And therefore, you get this usual contrast between... You know, in the people who made their name in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, or whatever, making fortunes on their living on the Tuscan vineyards and whatever,
yeah.
as compared to the strugglers and the strivers and the Brits, and where's all
as
this?
If that was never the case beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. And also for bands of tomorrow, as you quite rightly point out, there probably won't be any bands of tomorrow. You know, certainly don't appear to be. The way, you know, you describe the Brits, it's an individual business.
It's partly an economic thing, you know. It's a lot cheaper than a solo artist as a lumbering great, you know, gang you've got to cart around with you.
But one of the things in this piece is saying, you know, it's going to be difficult for the average band. And I was just thinking that, who's the average band?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Was there ever an average band who kind of settled... for being in the middle of the pack, you know what I mean? Not completely out of the game and not at the top of it either. I don't think it ever worked like that, did it? You know? And I mean, so many of the attempts to predict what will happen in the music business in the future are just completely, they're wasted breath. Because what we've seen, you know, we've seen a lot of change, haven't we, Mark? We remember when it was green fields around here. And none of the things that have happened have been anything that anybody predicted at all, have they?
No.
You know, nobody predicted at any point in the 70s or 80s. I'll tell you what, in the future, there will be DJs who will be paid millions of dollars for playing records. For playing records.
The same records every night, possibly.
Nobody predicted that whatsoever. You know, nobody predicted streaming. Nobody predicted you might pay £200 for a ticket to go to a festival. Nobody predicted that at all. So nobody knows what's going to happen with this stuff in the future, do they, at all?
No, not a clue.
And trying to predict...
And it changes so rapidly, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and then it may not change for a while, and then suddenly it changes by, you know, technology, economy, all kinds of things, you know. And so I've just had it with reading pieces about... You know, there used to be a time in the record business when everybody made a very good living, and now it's all gone away as a consequence of streaming or whatever. Because feed into that, a thing that I sent you, I think, this week, is a very good piece.
Oh, the Bob Lefsetz thing.
On the Bob Lefsetz letter. Bob Lefsetz does a very good kind of industry newsletter and so forth. And he had a long piece contributed by a guy called David Macias, American, who runs a company called 30 Tigers, which does management and distribution and marketing services for loads and loads of kind of independent acts, I suppose, you know. And I don't know if it was in the course of that or somewhere else that I learned the staggering fact that there are 60,000 new songs uploaded to the streaming services every day.
Well, the thing that struck me about that is a really good piece. In fact, we should post it at the end of this. Is that in 2004, there were 50,000 albums a year, roughly 50,000, which made what it was, $12 billion profit, I think.
In between. It's not profit. It's just revenue. It comes in.
In 2020, there were 1.1 million albums, which made the same amount of revenue, which is really incredible. I kind of Googled this because I was really interested, and I found a statistic saying in 1970, just in the US, 4,000 albums came out. 5,000.
Yeah, possibly.
So that was broadly, that's just to know, there was 10 albums a day. And now, if you work out on the basis of that figure for 2020, it's 3,000 albums a day internationally. So it's just unbelievable, isn't it? The choice and how hard it would be to make yourself different and to differentiate.
Well, it's also it's a smaller portions world, you know. And more people are on smaller and smaller portions, because the other thing is that. If you go back to, I don't know, the 80s or the 90s, well, certainly the 80s.
Yeah.
The majority of records released were not independent. Now they are.
Yeah.
Because there's no gatekeeper to stop you. You know, the only way you could put out records back in the day was to sign a deal with EMI or Warner Brothers or CBS or whatever. You don't need that anymore. It's a completely, the gatekeepers have gone.
Gone.
And hey, everybody wanted the gatekeepers to go, didn't they? You know,
well, they wanted them to go, but now they've gone. You must miss that kind of element of the selection process, and also the fact that the gatekeepers brought with them all that A&R experience, so they could say to you, "Well, that's commercial, well, that isn't commercial," and you know, let me tell you from experience, this might work, and this kind of production might work, and all that kind of advice and all that perspective is kind of gone, isn't it? Just to a large extent.
And he also, this guy, David Macias, made a very good point at the end of this piece, which he made it as gently as he possibly could. And this is a guy who's immensely sympathetic to independent artists, you know, works for about 200 of them, you know. And this is independence. This is not people arguing about how much they're getting paid by Universal or whatever.
Yeah.
And he says that the rate of business failure in the United States, I think he said, is 65%. So 65% of businesses that launch don't work. Really, are bands any different from that? Should they be any different from that? And that's a really interesting point.
Should we expect them? Is it because the general thing is it's unfair? It's unfair because Ed Sheeran's making an absolute fortune. All these people say it was always thus. It just was.
And I was only looking this morning on the streaming playlist, you know, the kind of the playlists of, you know, most streamed tunes right now. And you go down the top 30 and you won't have heard of any of them, Mark. But the top one has 34 million streams. So that puts absolutely everybody else in the shade, you know. And it may only have 34 million streams for, you know, a few weeks, but hey, that's a heck of a lot of streams too. And you know, it's a totally different business
from which they earn £17.10.
Well, if you get 34 million, you get a lot of money.
You're doing well.
You get a real lot of money, but if you get what sounds, you know, if you get 10,000, you don't.
No,
you know. And of course, the problem is people think 10,000, isn't that like selling 10,000 records back in the day? No, it's not. It's getting something played once. It's like radio play. It's a completely different thing. Anyway, we'll post that because it's really worth reading.
Yeah, it's really worth reading. It's brilliant.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So Film Club, here we are, Barry Norman style. We've finally been to see the same film, haven't we? You went to see Belfast, I think, a week or so ago, and I went to see it this week.
What a fantastic film. Let's be honest. It's gone quiet. I thought it was fantastic. There are elements of it a little bit over-sugary, a little bit over-sentimental, and a bit...
Just a touch.
But I still thought it was terrific. Fantastic. Anybody who hasn't seen it will know. It's the Kenneth Branagh story about... You know, a 10-year-old boy playing the part of him as he grew up in Belfast, you know, during the Troubles. But, Dave, the soundtrack, phenomenal.
The soundtrack is, of course, mainly Van Morrison. And, of course, this came as a surprise to me because you scanned the publicity material for Belfast in vain to find any mention of Van Morrison. Not on the poster, as far as I could see, and not to the fore at all. Is this because he hasn't just blotted his copybook over, you know, the vaccines?
He's sipped an entire bucket of quink.
Absolutely, he has.
It's Jackson Pollock-style expression. They've gone very quiet about him in the publicity, and understandably so. But you can separate the man from the music.
Absolutely. And listen, the thing that I tell you, I mean, I quite enjoyed the film. I have to say, and I'm not being sarcastic at all, when I say that the bit of the experience I enjoyed most, and I was in a nice, comfy cinema with a very good sound system, which is not something you could always say in the past. And the bit I enjoyed most was right at the end, was the titles were rolling, credits were rolling, and they played the whole of And the Healing Has Begun by Van Morrison. And so you're sitting there in a darkened cinema. You're just looking at a black screen with white credits going past. And you're utterly focused on the music, aren't you? Because that's always been the power of music in cinema, that it can exclude everything else and make you listen in a way that you don't listen.
And you're hearing it ordinarily. On a massive sound system.
A marvelous sound system.
Lots of different directions, and you're completely submerged in it.
And I just thought it was wonderful, because the thing that's interesting, you know, Van Morrison, well, he wrote those early songs which were about Belfast, but, you know, loads of other things that he wrote in America and so forth. And so very few of them are specifically about Belfast, apart from those kind of early ones. But still, he is associated in your mind with the place of Belfast more completely than any other musician I can think of other city.
I totally agree with that. You know, you look at the details in his songs, where he's not just talking about the streets and Cypress Avenue and Hindford Street or whatever, or he's talking about the Hollow, he's talking about Davy's Chipper, you know, and he's talking about, you know, gravy rings and wagon wheels and barn bracks and snowballs and just elements of Belfast life that are part of the fabric of that whole world. And you could argue that I think to some extent Joy Division sum up an essence of Manchester. If I hear Joy Division, I kind of get the feeling of how I imagine Manchester might be. And you could probably say the same about the Smiths. There's a little bit of that about the Grateful Dead with San Francisco, and maybe the Kinks with early London, and certainly the Leith with the Proclaimers, but New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen. But has anybody been associated that closely as Van Morrison in Belfast? I doubt it.
I don't think so. And he just keeps, you know, reappearing on the soundtrack. I think he's written what he wrote one new song.
Yeah, there's one new song on there. Yeah.
But most of it's, I don't know, Bright Side of the Road and Jackie Wilson Said and the Healing Has Begun. And he's just got that sound. It's kind of, it's Irish American. It's, you know, it sounds like the sea to me.
It does. It does.
It sounds like the open air. Van Morrison, you know.
Yeah.
And it just absolutely works in that film. And I think if you took away Van Morrison music from that film, it wouldn't have anything like the resonance it has. Because I think it all comes from the music.
Yeah, and to the extent that I think they should have actually stuck to entirely Van Morrison, because there's a load of other stuff in there. You know, at one point you get Everlasting Love by the
Love Affair,
which is great and it sounds lovely. But I mean, you might as well just stick in the same frame, I think. You could so easily have done the whole thing illustrated by Van Morrison.
I think so. But, you know, that was my favourite bit, as the bit right at the end. And another item on Film Club, I'd like to recommend this to anybody who hasn't seen it. Booksmart is on the BBC iPlayer this week.
Oh, you mentioned that. I've not had time to see it yet. But go on. Why did you like it so much?
Booksmart is a film, probably only made a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, something like that. And it's about two teenage girls who are 18 years old, who have dedicated themselves so much to getting into studying hard at school, to getting into Harvard or wherever, that they realize on the last night of school that they've forgotten to party. They haven't done any of that at all. And so this is your classic kind of rites of passage film, which we've seen many.
What a brilliant twist as well, because it's conventionally the other way around. Do nothing but cane it for 3 years and then panic. You know?
And they've gone the other way around. And it's a fascinating insight into, you know, growing up nowadays, if you like, you know, because young people have some issues that are the same and some issues that are very, very different. And so what intrigues me is that they're simultaneously kind of very advanced and very outrageous. and also at the same time, almost Victorian in their prudishness about certain things, which you can imagine, you know, which is summed up really well by, I was just watching a bit of it this morning, where one of them says to another, talking about a boy in their class, says, is it true his parents bought him a sex worker for his 14th birthday? Which I just thought that was wonderful. It's a really outrageous idea. But then it's a sex worker. It's not a hooker, you know.
No.
Everybody has to have a contemporary euphemism at absolutely every stage because that's the world they've grown up in, you know. And
it makes it sound okay, doesn't it? Acceptable.
Well, I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It's really funny. We were talking, we did a recording this week with Alexis Petridis.
It
was fantastic.
Really
Alexis.
Fantastic. So many theories.
Absolutely. I don't know if it's out there yet. It's probably not, but it will be soon. And it's really good. He talked about all kinds of things. And he talked about he's got a daughter who's 15, 16, I think. And he's very illuminating on the subject of how younger people get to hear music and their differing relationships with music and so forth. But he said his daughter had said to him she liked Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Was that right. And so he found her, Tiny Tim, doing Tiptoe Through the Tulips on YouTube. And she looked at it, absolutely horrified.
Danger. That's right.
Absolutely horrified, you know. Whereas we all used to look at Tiny Tim and thought, well, he's a bit odd, you know what I mean? But it's like, you know, the definition of odd has so changed, you know, over the years. So if you present a thing like that to a 16-year-old nowadays, it's like, what are you showing me this for?
Yeah.
I shouldn't be seeing this.
It's a picture that'd be shown in class that came with a very strong warning. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, anyway. So, Alexis, I do recommend that... that you catch up with it if you haven't already done
so. It's so good.
It's absolutely excellent.
So many ideas.
We've had some really good ones over the last few weeks, and we'll have more good ones in the future, which you can support our important work if you're not already doing so. And if you're already doing so, you'd be watching this, not just listening to it, by being a Patreon supporter. Patreon.com, word in your ear, full details there. More of that later on. Great excitement, Mark. Great excitement. Finally.
Your CD.
My CD.
Absolutely. Your four pack.
Four CDs, Mark. It's not just one.
I know.
This is great excitement. I've been thinking about this for... I've been boring you on the subject for, you know, more than 2 years.
You've been sending me for the last, I don't know, what's been 18 months or something, just odd ideas of things you're doing. And so I'm thinking of choosing one of these and, oh, listen to this. It's Freddie King or whatever. And it's so funny. But explain the idea. Basically, it's a four CD thing.
It's four CD set. Yeah, I don't know. People may be familiar with this. Demon Records have done these collections with Gary Crowley and with Steve Lamacq in the past, where basically they focus on an area and, you know, somebody's particular interest and somebody does the selection and kind of fronts it, if you like. And so they came to me and said, would you like to put together a compilation of your favorite 70s records? And it's like, would I?
That is everybody's fantasy. It's just a lovely idea because it's, you know, there's all the stuff that we all know and, you know, sold lots of records. And then there's all those things that you thought were better.
The thing they said to me was, don't pick the obvious, you know, because it's not, you know, all the greatest respect. It's not Jeremy Clarkson's 70s, you know what I mean? It's not mainstream. It's not Hotel California. And,
well, it's,
you know,
occasionally got quite a key well-known in the UK, isn't it? But it's just less well-known tracks.
So, you pick less well-known tracks or well-known songs by people who you might not know that they wrote the song did the song or whatever. And so that's what I set out to do. And they said, we want four CDs. Each of those CDs ought to have some kind of thematic unity to it. You know, so I've got four CDs. And the first one's called...
So go through this as Young Americans.
The first one's called Young Americans, and it's about people who just happen to be young Americans at the time, you know, so it's...
Delaney and Bonnie and Mike Nesmith.
Yeah, yeah. It's Mike Nesmith, it's John Prine, it's Warren Zevon, you know, it's Jesse Winchester, it's all kinds of people like that, personal favourites of mine. And then the second CD, which is where I've stolen the title from ZZ Top, Beer Drinkers and Hell Raisers, which is about... you know, loud 70s rock and roll and R&B. And, you know, it's about Freddie King and Johnny Winter and Montrose and the Jay Giles Band and all that kind of stuff. Stuff we used to play in my flat in Wood Green while, you know, headbanging back in 1974. Yeah. So that's and it's also, I hope, the ultimate in-car CD experience. Please don't go too fast, readers. And then the third CD is Blue Ball Blues, which is
such a good title, because anybody our age gets that straight away. When you're going up and down a motorway, back in the day, there was the Blue Ball service station, wasn't it?
Where you would stop, what for gap,
have revolting food. In fact, Roy Harper actually wrote a song about it. What's it?
He did. Food is the worst. He got sued, didn't he? It's about Watford Gap, and there was a line, there was a rhyme with Watford Gap, which I won't draw attention to.
That's right. But it's all about that time when people were just in old Comer vans, weren't they? Just kind of, you know, steaming up and down from.
So this is who I've got on Blue Ball Blues.
Yeah,
Ronnie Lane and Slim Chance, Family, Murray Head, Bebop Deluxe, The Motors, The Records, Pato. Singing the Blues on Reds.
Sharks.
That was the Andy Fraser,
Chris Spedding group.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Jess Roden, Terry Reid, Robert Palmer, Mott the Hoople, Fairport Convention, Dave Edmonds, Chili Willy and the Red Hot Peppers, ladies and gentlemen.
And Bruce Lee. That's a good example, because the Motors track, was it Dancing the Night Away?
Dancing the Night Away.
That's kind of quite well known, but they're a kind of obscurish group, aren't they? But other times it's kind of it's completely unknown groups with an artist with tracks that you might not have heard of.
And then finally, the great Roy Harper, the aforementioned Roy Harper, When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease.
Yeah, brilliant.
You know, so, you know, the opportunity to put that on the CD was too good to miss. And the fourth CD is all female acts, because, you know, it's very often said in the 70s there were hardly any female acts. You know, it was always Sandy Denny and Elke Brooks and Maggie Bell, and that's your lot.
Joan Armour Trading.
Actually, there were lots, but, you know, very often they didn't particularly come to prominence, you know, or came to prominence years later. So I've got Sandy Denny, obviously, Marianne Faithfull, Linda Ronstadt, Carly Simon, Joan Armour Trading, Kate Nana McGarrigle, your favourite song?
My absolute fave.
Heart Like a Wheel. Maria Muldaur, Wendy Waldman, Valerie Simpson, Ellen Foley. Ellen Foley, who sang with Meatloaf on Bad Out of Hell, didn't she?
Yeah.
Phoebe Snow, Linda Lewis, Valerie Carter, The Roaches, Bridget St. John, and so on and so forth. Judy Sill, all kinds of people like that. I have to tell you, You might think putting together a CD, a full CD set, was just unmitigated joy. And let me tell you, you're right.
It was. I can imagine. Anyone listening would be weak with envy.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Well, I was reading the other day, well, you've read it too, the piece that I think Danny Baker had posted, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, because it makes the point that all over the music industry, there are people, historically, there have been people who think there's a pile of cash and they deserve a bit of it. And whether they do or they don't, and in this case, I think they really genuinely do, how hard it is to get any of that money back. And it's a story about a guy called Burton Silverman, who was the artist who painted in 1970, the three pictures that finished up being used as artwork on Jethro Tull's Aqualung. And it's an extraordinary tale, isn't it? I mean, he's Terry Ellis, who was running Chrysalis at the time and massively involved with the creative elements of Jethro Tull, had seen his artwork and liked it and had commissioned him and given him a blank canvas, again, which is another reason why he seems to deserve something. It was his idea to take the idea of the character from the song Aqualung and paint this kind of this derelict, you know, out on the street. And Ian Anderson never liked the picture. And anyway, it was used, and the record was enormous, and in subsequent different formats, CDs and cassettes and all that, you know, it still got used. And Burton Silverman eventually felt that he deserved some money, didn't he?
Well, just a second, he got some money.
He got $1,500.
$1,500.
Reasonable amount of money.
1970 is a lot of money.
No, reasonable amount of money, absolutely.
And he got a trip to Britain for him and his wife. Come over and
he came to watch the band rehearse.
Extraordinary way people did things in those days. Come over, watch the band rehearse and do some sketches, which he did, from which, you know, all this stuff derived. Was there a contract? No. Did he get a lawyer involved? No. Nothing at all. Did he think that this was going to prove to have an afterlife? No. Did Jethro Tull think this? No.
No, probably not.
Nobody at all.
But then what happened is that, rather like the Rolling Stones' lips, you know, that artwork, that image from the front of Aqualung became a kind of logo for the group, didn't it? It's as recognisable as, possibly more so, actually, as any other kind of representation of Jethro Tull. And therefore, there are coffee mugs being sold with it on, and there are posters and there are T-shirts, and it's just become a massive part of their merchandise operation. So the whole story is about him trying to kind of get the money back. And what he does is, he realizing that the legal procedure against Warner Brothers is going to be complicated, he goes individually to both Terry Ellis and Ian Anderson, and they both say kind of no, don't they? They point out that they think the deal is fair and that they can't help him.
But also, it must be, you know, and this is 50 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the ownership of Aqualung will have changed. You know, Chrysalis was Pearl Island, I think, at the time. And then it was independent. And then it went to, what, EMI, did it? I can't remember. And then sold on probably Warner Brothers in the States, as
Warner
you
Brothers
say.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And you know, this becomes an asset of some multinational, one of millions of assets that they own. And do they really want to unpick one bit of it? I wouldn't have thought that they do at all, you know. And it's always very difficult to go back and say, well, you know, you are owed a little bit more, because couldn't somebody else say that they're owed a little bit more?
Well, that's right. I don't know. If you settled one case, a load of other people would think that they had a chance, would they?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's very difficult, and because I don't know if people are ever happy with these things, you know. You know, if you're going to have a full and final settlement, it would have to be, and as soon as you get learned friends involved, the sums involved have to be four times as high
to pay
for learned friends.
Yeah,
everybody,
friends, will drag it out indefinitely if they're representing the deep pocketed record company.
We can't let a mention of my learned friends go past this week without strongly suggesting that anybody who hasn't already done so should get across the details of the case that's known as Wagatha Christie at the moment between Colleen Rooney and Jamie Vardy's wife.
It's fantastic.
Yes, fantastic.
Just a point of detail here, that I think the cost of this case legally is £500 a minute, wasn't it? And they had a 10-hour session on one day. So that, I think, is that £300,000 one day?
You always wondered how, you know, sorry, we're just tangented to football.
Yeah.
You know, the footballers back in the day used to make a lot of money when they played, and then they drank it afterwards, didn't they? You know, they always ended up on potless by running a pub or whatever. and nowadays, they earn ridiculous sums of money to the extent you think, how are they going to lose these sums of money? I think we've got a hint here.
They find ways. They sometimes involving a cat. They're imaginative new ways.
This is, and I do love the detail that Mrs. Vardy lost her phone in the North Sea.
In the sea. That's right.
No, not just the sea, Mark. The North Sea.
That's right, yeah.
You know, what is Mrs. Vardy doing anywhere near the North Sea? I really do not know. Anyway, sorry, how do we get?
No, it's fantastic. We're
talking about middle-aged friends.
The idea that the Aqualung artwork also is lost, wasn't it?
Yes.
This is the thing about the story of John Pash, who was the art student from Royal College of Art, who Jagger's brilliant. Jagger had seen his work. Jagger's idea to do the lips and thought this was the guy to do it, and he did it, and it was so fantastic. And eventually the Stones gave him some more money because they were brilliant it was. But also, somehow he had retained copyright to that thing. He sold the logo for, I think, something like £400,000. Now, the guy who painted the Aqualung sleeve, you know, Burton Silverman, it couldn't do that because the painting's missing, isn't it?
He ain't got it.
I think it's been stolen or it's just missing. I mean, nobody knows where it is. So that was his one other revenue is, okay, I can't get a percentage for this, you know, but I could at least sell the original. Hasn't even got the original.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
We're joined by our special Patreon birthday guest, Nick Foreman. Happy birthday. Is it today, Nick?
No, it's a couple of days' time on the 15th. On the 15th.
And where are you, Nick?
Well, I'm calling from Leicester.
All right.
Leicester. So this afternoon I've got the 4:30 kickoff against West Ham.
Which we're
running on to later on.
Are you a regular?
I am, season ticket, but not only Johnny Come Late, because I was there when we were in
We were shit.
Yeah, basically, yeah. although we've had a tradition of winning for the last sort of 8 or 9 years, generally speaking.
Right.
Have you won the league famously a few years ago?
Have you got a kind of a new section of supporters who are only used to the good times, who are possibly...
I think it was the case. I mean, when they started to get good and popular commensurately, the stadium filled up. So we've always got a full house.
Right. Oh, well, best of luck this afternoon.
When you won the league, the entire city appeared to take a week off to go mental. Was that the impression?
It'd make an amazing documentary, and it probably has done, actually. Not least that it was done on a sort of ragtag and bobtail team with brilliant team spirit. And, of course... won by 10 clear points and didn't just sort of eke out that.
No, absolutely.
It was incredible.
No.
It was absolutely thrilling, the whole thing.
Yeah. So what are you doing on your birthday? Have you got a programme of activities worked out?
No, in fact, I'm just going to be in the office on my birthday, it being a Tuesday. My son shares the same birthday as me, so in some respects he's always sort of overshadowed.
I bet.
Yes, absolutely.
a little bit. But now they're both sort of free, and at the moment we're sort of empty nest and just trying to reconcile with that now.
So you're empty nest because they're at university or whatever?
That's right, yes. Yeah, the youngest one just went down to Loughborough last September.
So can I just tell you, from the point of view of experience, they don't go away forever. They come back.
Right. They come back. They do. come back, and they expect a well-stocked fridge. Yeah,
well, absolutely. Loughborough was only 10 minutes away
from. Yeah, there you go. There you go. And when they do finally, kind of leave home properly, they still leave most of their possessions behind them and insist that you don't throw them away. Anyway, it's traditional. We've only been doing this a few weeks. It's traditional that our birthday guest gets to set the agenda for this little part of the podcast. Anything you'd like to raise, question, whatever?
Indeed, I have perhaps two questions and see which one you might prefer to answer.
All right. Oh, there's a choice.
As part of the word in your ear Christmas tradition, we had our get-together on Boxing Day when we were supposed to tell everybody what we got for Christmas. And I'd slightly misread the email and just told you I'd got monogrammed towels. So my first question would be, has there been any time in your journalistic career when you've had a head in your hands, I really wish I didn't write that or I regret writing that, either good or bad, that you just thought, oh, I got it. Oh, my word.
Oh, people always say about, oh, sorry, we're going to choose the question. Yeah. All right, go on, carry on.
And the second question is, and obviously with the recent passing of Meatloaf, I've just sort of picked two or three album covers. And I was wondering, in your opinion, yes, whether those album covers had actually, in some measure, either helped, hindered, or indeed advanced the reputation of the music within.
Oh, God.
Well, I think the album covers is a good question, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Oh, well, it's, you know, the I've kind of written a book about this, really, you know, that they, and the thing I always say is that whereas George Orwell's 1984 is republished every 10 years with a different cover to bring it up to date notionally, nobody would dream of doing that with a classic album, because the cover is as much the album as the music within. I don't think that applies with CDs, but I think it applied with the 12-inch, you know, LP. And so, you know, you held up Sgt. Pepper, obviously, you know, that is, you know, we look at that and we can hear that record, can't we? Still to this day, you know, the people encounter the visual image of Sgt. Pepper more frequently than they encounter the music. And that's why it's embedded inside us, isn't it? It's not just listening to it, it's looking at it. And, you know, I know a lot of people said this when Meatloaf died the other week, you know, that was the cover of Bat Out of Hell a contributor to the success of that album? Well, clearly it was. And he was a very respected kind of comic book artist, wasn't he? That guy who, I don't know, comic book is a bit sniffy way of referring to him. I think it was the only cover he did, wasn't it? That was quite a big deal, him doing it. For people who follow that world, I have to confess I don't. And I think it was hugely important. Whereas you also held up Trap Mass Replica, which for those who haven't seen it, is Captain Beefheart wearing a trout's head, there you are, with a hat over the top of it. And that would certainly not encourage people to pick up that record.
It's a kind of crass and reductive concept in some ways. Don't you think? You think they could have come up with something so much more imaginative and everlasting? But you can't disassociate it with the record. It's just there are various sleeves, aren't there? Atom Heart Mother, and I think King Crimson's first album of the Crimson King. That album sleeve has just come into the frame in the last few years as being one of those absolutely classic albums.
Well, you know the story of that guy, the guy who painted it. It's called Barry. Is he? I can't remember his second name.
He's an old mate of theirs. Was he an old school friend or something?
He was a guy somebody knew. Was at university in I think it was him, Imperial College.
Yeah.
And I think he was a scientist, but he just did these kind of, you know, larger than life illustrations as a hobby, and they said to him, just do one for us. And so what he did reputedly was he got in front of a mirror.
It's his own mouth, isn't it?
Opened his mouth and then painted the resulting image, which, you know, ended up being, it was all the kind of publicity that King Crimson needed, wasn't it? In those days, I remember the time that record came out, which was 69, is it? And you went to record shops, and the whole window of record shops were just taken up with covers of In the Court of the Crimson King. And everybody bought it because curiosity, what could that sound like if it looked like that?
And there was nothing else on that cover apart from, there was nothing, no words else on it. Nothing.
And I don't think there's nothing on the outside. Album.
Yeah.
But of course, Atom Heart Mother is even more extraordinary.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Because the story, you know, they just had this they had this long piece. So I'm gonna go a tangent on Atom Heart Mother.
Yeah.
It's my specialist subject at the moment. They developed a long piece that they used to call the pudding or something like that within the band. And then they wanted to record it. So they started off with a run track with Mason and Roger Waters. And they had to play it quite long, and there was no way of editing it or something. So they had to try and keep time, which was not something Pink Floyd were terribly good at. And then they couldn't finish it, and they had to go on tour in the States. So they got, what's his face? Is it Ron Geeson, the arranger, mm-hmm. the guy that Roger Waters had done the body with, and said, just kind of write, do a tune on the top of this, you know. So Ron Geeson labored all summer to do this whole thing. And then when they got to the studio to record it, they had a load of session players in who were choosing to be rather sniffy that day. And Ron Geeson almost had a fist fight with one of the horn players. And eventually the producer had to say, Ron, why don't you just come in the booth here and let somebody else conduct, because there's going to be fisticuffs in there. And that's the thing that ended up being called Atom Heart Mother, purely because somebody saw that headline, Atom Heart Mother, in the Daily Mail.
In the newspaper, yeah.
And then the cow...
This is a hypnosis sleeve, wasn't it?
I'm going to tell you about this, Mark. That cow, I'm getting this from the recesses of my memory. The name of the cow, I think, was Lulu Bell. And was a cow photographed in a field near Potter's Bar, because Storm Thorgerson's mother lived in Potter's Bar.
Yeah.
And so they just basically went out there and said, find the first cow you can get to stand still, take a picture. And then go into the band and saying, there's your cover.
There's your cover. And they go, that's it.
That's it. I know. And so the key part of the identity of Atom Heart Mother all these years later is the cow. It's not the music, is it? Nobody's sitting around talking about fourth track on Atom Heart Mother. That's what it is.
Precisely.
It's the cow.
On this Meatloaf album, everybody's credited except, it seems, the artist, the cover artist.
Oh, really? You surprised me.
On the back, let me just reread that. Yeah, it tells you Todd Rundgren's involved and Jim Steinman's involved.
Yeah,
and, who even mastered it. It's dedicated to Wesley and Wilmer Aday and Louis Lewis Steinman. On nothing about who.
Oh, really? A
grand tradition. We were talking about that earlier on this very podcast, actually.
Yeah.
Aqualung cover and the fate that awaited the guy who painted the picture on the front of that.
I don't know if Sergeant Pepper does actually say Peter. Oh, it does say Peter.
Does it say Jan Howarth?
Oh, yeah, staged by Peter Blake and
it was his wife and collaborator at the time, and you know, she was the person. Well, she did an awful lot of it, didn't she? Getting together all those extraordinary things. So yes, I think the answer to your question is, you know, that the visual images attached to 12-inch LPs were absolutely core to their appeal.
Yeah,
separable, and you simply wouldn't change them. Whereas CD, as soon as you do it that size, it sort of doesn't matter. There's a theory, the great Jackson Browne, I mean, if you think of Jackson Browne's first album cover, sorry, am I boring you? But sorry, it's my specialist subject. The first Jackson Browne album cover is a canvas water carrier that in those days you used to fill up with water and then put over the radiator of your car when you went driving in the desert, so it stopped it overheating.
With a weird and meaningless phrase on it, isn't it? The picture.
Well, no, it's not meaningless at all once you know it's a canvas bag because it's saturate before using.
That's right, but you don't, yes.
Whereas on the album, nobody really knew, you know, yeah. at all. But his theory was that album covers were like the shields of Native American warriors. So a warrior coming to manhood would choose his symbols that would represent him. I don't know, eagles, trees, God knows what. And these would be on a shield. And a shield is roughly the same size, same area as a 12-inch album cover, which again is roughly the same area as a design on a T-shirt. And it just kind of works, that theory.
So that's the optimum size.
That's the optimum size. If you do it smaller, it simply doesn't work. And it's that whole idea that you can walk down the street with it under your arm and people knew, well, they didn't know what it was. You know, I was thinking about this with the Asmart mother, particularly people walking into the bus station in 1971 or whatever, with that under their arm. Everybody else thought, he's got a picture of a cow. No, people thought, he's got a copy of Asmart.
Message, wasn't it? Completely. I know. And the moment it became reduced to the CD, the people just lost interest in that kind of detail because you just couldn't see it. It just became a kind of logo and a kind of sell, really.
So your second question, I cannot answer in detail. All I'll say is that, like everybody who's spent a lot of their time writing, and Mark will probably be the same, there are occasions when we snap into the fetal position under the duvet in the middle of the night, when we think about things we have said or written that didn't prove to be true. That's just the way it goes, isn't it, really? That's the nature of the job.
Details.
That's the nature of the job.
It is, completely. Sometimes you just get it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's like doing podcasts, you know. People say, oh, you got something wrong. Well, you know, you're opening a mic and you're talking for an hour and a half. You're about to get something wrong. I hope there's nothing too terribly wrong in what we've just said, Nick.
No, that's lovely. Thank you.
Okay. Well, have a good birthday.
Have a great birthday on Tuesday.
And all the very best. Cheers.
The Word Podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
And here we are, Any Other Business, joined by Alex Gold. Where are you now, Alex?
I am in swinging Miami, where it is raining, would you believe?
Good. That's pretty comforting.
Serves you right.
I won't mention that it's also 23 degrees, but...
I'm just so glad it's raining. That's great.
Major dilemma this morning because I wasn't really sure whether I could wear shorts or not.
Terrible.
I've actually gone for skinny jeans, just so you know.
So, any correspondence from the Massive? Anything we should be dealing with? Go on.
We've had quite a lot of feedback for Giles Fraser's 5 in 5.
Thing.
So basically the concept of 5 in 5 for everybody who wasn't with us last week is any artists that have put out 5 great records in 5 years consecutively. Andrew Slattery via Patreon has suggested Roxy Music. So Roxy Music, 1972, For Your Pleasure, 73. Stranded, also 73.
Wow.
Country Life.
Yep.
74 and Siren 75.
Wow, I've forgotten
all
those
5 years. That's amazing.
That's
a winning streak, actually.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is good. It is.
It's a purple patch.
Glenn Crouch, also via Patreon, posits Stevie Wonder. I haven't got years here, but I've got the album titles: Music of My Mind, Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfillingness First Finale, and Songs in the Key of Life.
You're not wrong about that.
No, that's a really good choice.
Not wrong about that. And actually, more than one of the... There's one double in there, isn't it? Songs in the Key of Life is a double, isn't it? It's even more remarkable.
Technically 6, yeah. Chuck Lonson, all the way from Swingin' Georgia on Patreon, puts forward REM. Murmur, 1983. Reckoning, 84. Fables of the Reconstruction, 85. Life's Rich Pageant, 86. And Document, 87.
That's liftoff, isn't it? Really is. That's fantastic.
Ian Gould, also via Patreon. Miles Davis. Miles in the Sky, 1968. Fields de Kilimanjaro, 1969. In a Silent Way, also 1965. Sorry, 69, sorry. Bitches Brew, 1970. Jack Johnson, 1971.
Very good.
Great albums in 4 years, he points out. And John Morris, also via Patreon, suggests Brian Eno with Another Green World, Discreet Music, Before and After Science, Ambient One, Music for Airports, and Music for Films.
I don't know if Brian Eno counts. Half of those are silence, aren't they?
Can you get that excited about those ones? I'm not really sure, actually.
I like Brian Eno.
I know, but I mean, I just don't know how utterly classic they are.
Would you know which one was playing, which one was next? You know, I'm not sure you would. We're actually, to correct something, pedantic correction from Mark Stevens. We said that Ed Sheeran was a Chelsea supporter. He's not. He's an Ipswich supporter.
Oh, is he? Sorry about that.
So he knows about pain, you know. And so who else? Yeah, we were talking about things that were inscribed on the back of album covers, with instructions as to how to play them loud and so forth, you know. And Andrew Slattery has found this on the rear cover of a Horselips Dancehall Sweethearts. There's going back. It says, the note says, file under reasonably popular. I don't That's remember good. That. Whether, that's very good.
That's Horse good.
There's been no Horselips revival, has there? No, it hasn't happened at all.
Not yet. No, we're on tenterhooks.
Yeah.
Any moment.
This week we've also launched our Down the Rabbit Hole special service for Patreon supporters, in which Mark and I go down the rabbit hole in pursuit of personal obsessions of ours, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, in ridiculous detail. And it's been very warmly received.
It has.
Very, really encouraging.
We will do more. The first one's about the Dave Clark Five. There'll be more coming in due course. And if you'd like to get one of these. And, of course, we make them available via the genius of Patreon. We make these so that they come through your podcast provider, don't we, Alex? I think that's fair to say. So if you'd like to join up the ranks of our Patreon supporters, and we'd love you to do that, if you go to patreon.com/wordinyourear, and the full details will be there. What else we got to talk about, Alex? We've penciled in our word in the park for
June
the
18th.
18th.
It's a Saturday. We've booked the weather.
We've booked the weather.
Sunshine. Yep.
It's in Holland Park. Further details will be coming of that in due course.
We must mention again the Alexis Petridis one, which is coming out soon, which is fantastic.
Yep.
There are lots more in the bag.
And we're also actually look out for me and Mark Ellen to mark the release of my 4-CD set, Deep 70s, which is coming out at the end of May. Mark and I will be droning on about old records.
Live and in appearance.
Live than you'll ever be at Rough Trade East. And so further details of that underneath this.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.